You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, I'm welcoming you for the final time in 2025, the year of the POG again, pretending we were fluent in UCI points before the third week in October, and me realising that High Rocks is just cyclocross for people who don't want mud on their Lululemon. My name is Daniel Freeman, and I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will lock into review, not preview mode, and think specifically about what 2026 may hold for one of the more controversial figures of 2025. That is Juan Ayuso, now of Little Trek, not UAE Team Emirates. Joining me for the final time before we sleigh ride off into the festive holidays, it is the bearded wonder of not Lapland, but not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Merry Christmas, Daniel. A Merry Christmas to everyone who celebrates. Season's greetings and happy holidays and so on to everyone.
Well, we're going to turn Scrooge straight away, Lionel, because you might be wondering about the reference to High Rocks and cyclocross. I was just one of our colleagues, Ned Bolting, I think he's done a podcast, Room 101 style podcast, and it got me wondering if we ever did such a thing, how I would resist the urge to chuck. If it was cycling related, I'd probably chuck cyclocross in there. If it was non-cycling related, I'd probably chuck High Rocks in there. This probably tells you a lot about my internet algorithm, obviously my Instagram algorithm, because I run, it's full of sort of anti-High Rocks propaganda, and this has influenced my worldview on such things, I would say. Anyway, that was a long digression.
I mean, Daniel, it's Christmas. Tis the season for cyclocross. Cyclocross couldn't be busier over the next couple of weeks. Christmas and New Year. I might punish you here by just mentioning a little bit of the cyclocross before we go over to Juan Ayuso.
That reference was also very strategic to tee you up for a mention of cyclocross.
I love cyclocross.
Do you want to save that?
Yeah, save it. We'll save it.
Say that. Well, Lionel, as I said, we're going to have another bulletin dispatch from Spain. Me in conversation with Dani Arribas, who was at the Little Trek training camp media day, which was about 10 days ago now, 2 weeks ago now. And he was there mainly for an audience with Juan Ayuso, who of course obviously was the big sort of new arrival for Little Trek, the big story of that media day, his departure for UAE. From UAE, and we will hear later on whether he wanted to broach that subject or not. But that's going to be the main part of the podcast today. Hope everyone finds it interesting. But before that, Lionel, a bit of important news to catch up on, mainly news from Spain, in fact, because La Vuelta a España was presented, the 2026 Vuelta a España was presented, not in Spain, but in Monaco last week. I'm losing track of the days. I think it was last week. So we now know what the 21 stages are going to be. We knew before that, of course, that the Vuelta was going to start in Monaco on the Formula One circuit. We knew, we'd heard rumours as well, murmurings about how hard the Vuelta was going to be, that it was possibly going to be the hardest Vuelta of all time, certainly based on altitude meters. But the drapes, Lionel, or the sort of silk, has come off. It's been cast off the route of the 2026 Vuelta a España. And then, well, first thing to say, Lionel, was that I was quite impressed by the presentation, because we have the unfortunate recent precedent of the Giro presentation, which was an absolute example of how not to do things, in my opinion. I think we talked about it at the time, just an awful lot of sort of blandishments and awful lot of sort of thanking this politician, that sponsor, and so on and so forth. And it just went on and on, with the only caveat being that they also had to present the Giro Donne, of course, which, you know, so it adds, it's a sort of second part of the whole show. But it wasn't great. And the Vuelta presentation was very sort of to the point by comparison, I thought. And it was pretty decent. There was a little, you know, there were a little sort of, there were a couple of kind of tangents, but worthy ones. There was a bit of a tribute to Chris Froome, who we don't know officially he's retiring yet. But of course, he lives in Monaco. So they got him on stage and they sort of celebrated his Vuelta career. But otherwise, it was quite sort of straightforward, low fire. I quite liked it.
Just get to the point, really. Unveil the stages. I think that should be the headline of any Grand Tour route presentation. Keep it simple, focus on the sporting highlights, really. That's what everyone's tuning in to see. I think we talked about this when the Tour de France route was unveiled. They kind of don't really visually show you a very good sort of representation of this is the climb where this happened, you know, with old footage and what have you. And I think it could be really, well, we talked about this in relation to the Tour, but these events were never really conceived as television spectaculars. They were very much kind of corporate trade show type vibe, and they're sort of straddling two different worlds here now, aren't they? Because the public and the cycling fans do tune in and watch them online or on TV if they're broadcast, and so I think they need to kind of, you know, drag themselves into the 21st century, a quarter of a century too late.
Christmas Day, we should take inspiration from the Welter presentation, just unwrap the presents, firm handshake for your nearest and dearest, and off you go back home.
Well, they should take inspiration from the advent calendar. You know, what's behind door number one? Oh, it's a time trial in Monaco. What's behind door number seven? A disappointing unbranded chocolate.
Anyway, what did we learn? Well, we're not going to go through all the stages. Broad brushstrokes, this is going to be. We mentioned, I alluded there to the billing, sort of the pre-event billing. This was supposedly going to be one of the hardest Welters of all time, if not the hardest. That was based mainly on the number of altitude meters. This Welter comes in at around 58,000 meters of climbing, which is the most for a very long time. I think most people think ever. These things are quite difficult to sort of log and keep track on, and some of the figures that we see are often inaccurate, also because very often, particularly in the case of the Giro d'Italia, to sort of name and shame the Giro again, they don't know the exact route until much closer, in the Giro's case, until late April sometimes. So around 58,000 meters of climbing. The organization line are saying 4 medium mountain stages, 6 mountain stages, 2 individual time trials. So there's one in Monaco, 9 kilometers to kick things off in Monaco, so not officially a prologue, and then one later in the race. Whereas the other one is down, pretty much everything's in Andalusia, in the south of, the far south of Spain. But those are the sort of main headlines. Digging a little bit deeper, Lionel, another thing that I think most people agree with, there are a lot of stages, sort of versatile sprinters, stages with climbs, little climbs, interesting climbs, which, I don't know, could be springboards for GC riders, but will certainly be kind of guillotines for some of the sprinters, the pure sprinters that might go. So versatile sprinters, guys like Caden Groves, there's a lot there for those riders to sink their teeth into. Of course, we don't know who is going to be at the Vuelta yet. We talked last week about Pogacar's race program that he's unveiled. It wasn't even, how many days of racing was it before the Tour de France? It wasn't even 20. So he's going to be at well under 50 by the end of the Tour de France, which opens maybe the possibility of him doing the Vuelta, but he's certainly not committed to that yet. The northern regions snubbed, Galicia, Asturias, Basque Country, Cantabria, but one thing I would say to that line is that they get pretty big licks most years, almost every year, and certainly in recent history there have been Welters. Indeed, last year's Welter was primarily in the north, so I don't think that's a screaming injustice.
No, and I think everybody on the race, riders and everyone else, will enjoy the recent trend of keeping the route well joined up, really, as opposed to trying to cover the whole of Spain. I don't know the comparison between Spain and France and Italy in terms of, you know, overall area size, but logistically, it just feels like a bigger country, doesn't it? You know, in France, you can get from north to south quite easily in a few days, or even the transfers at least are on kind of big, heavily used autoroutes. Spain in the middle feels a lot more kind of rural, a lot less well connected. So, I mean, I know you've had some significant long, difficult drives from one end of the country to the other, and although the riders generally fly, it's been a feature of the Vuelta in, you know, not so distant past, that the route has really kind of challenged the logistics. So I think everyone would prefer it to be well joined up. I think my first Takeaway at a glance when I saw the route unveiled was the Gran Salida of Tax Havens with Monaco, followed by Andorra in the first few days. And then it kind of, it's got a real kind of 2016-17 vibe for me. There's not the kind of the A-list climbs that we associate with the Vuelta. I mean, we've been to Angliru and Lagos de Covadonga and so on over recent years. But there's a few names that leap out. For example, Alto de Aitana, which is where Pierre Latour won a stage in 2016. That was Chris Froome's Vuelta, wasn't it, as well? That was right at the end.
Yeah, it was sort of decided that day, Froome sort of staving off Nairo Quintana. No, Nairo Man winning the Vuelta. Nairo Man sort of, yeah. There was an attempt, obviously, there by Chris Froome to unseat him on the last big day.
Nairo
Man prevailed.
I think they had the time trial the day before, and I went home, missed the Alto de Aitana stage. But that's an interesting climb. And then Sierra de la Pandera, people will remember from recent years. Rafael Majka won there in 2017. Richard Carapaz in 2022. And, you know, even Andorra la Vella. I mean, it does feel like the Grand Tours go to Andorra a lot. But the Vuelta hasn't had a finish there since 2017. Vincenzo Nibali, a very similar sort of opening to the Vuelta that year, wasn't it? Because it started in Nîmes and then made its way around the corner. So there'll be shades of 2017 all through the Vuelta. And of course, the other big headline is the finish in Granada. The Alhambra will be the big image of the final stage of the Vuelta. No finish in Madrid, which we already knew, but the proposed finish in the Canary Islands not happening at the moment. That may well be on the agenda for future years, but Granada stepping in to host the finale of the 2026 Vuelta.
Yes, and interestingly, that final stage, as well as being very eye-catching, finishing next to the Alhambra, I don't know exactly where the finish line is going to be, but it's not going to be a procession by any stretch of the imagination, 99 kilometres, but five times up the, anyone who's been to Granada will know that the Alhambra is kind of on top of the hill above the city, and the race is going to go up that hill. It's going to be, I think it's about a kilometer around about there, but certainly, you know, gradients of sort of 7-8%, enough to potentially, well, eliminate sprinters again, or even if the race is close, be a bit of a sort of kingmaker maybe on the final day, in a similar fashion to Montmartre in the Tour de France.
Yeah, and of course it starts at the Carrefour hypermarket on the outskirts of Granada. You were there for a supermarket sweep stage, weren't you, Daniel? I wonder which aisle they'll start in. They'll start in the fresh fruit and vegetable aisle and then weave their way down past the cheese and out through the past the frozen goods and then across the car park. That's obviously a nod to Carrefour, the French supermarket chain, which is one of the major partners of the Vuelta a España and the Tour de France, isn't it? It sponsors the King of the Mountain. No, that's Intermarché. Oh, hang on, I'm getting all my supermarkets mixed
slightly
up here.
Well, slightly icky again, and it was last time for Lidl Trek and, well, Intermarché as well, and I can't remember what they did, but there was some sort of revenge PR stunt by Lidl Trek that day. When was it, last year or 2 years ago? That was in Andalusia as well, near Jerez de la Frontera. We started in Carrefour, I believe. Anyway, that is something to look forward to. Lionel, as we said, we don't know who's going to take part. We know Primoz Roglic is supposedly targeting the Vuelta, but we never really know at this point in the previous year who is going to be lined up at the Vuelta a España. But as I said, given what's on Pogacar's calendar, I wouldn't necessarily rule it out. I mean, you would imagine that if it was sort of a lighter, certainly in terms of kilometres, if it looked like a lighter Vuelta than usual, then that might incentivise him to take part. It's not particularly, I mean, the Vuelta, as we have learned over the last few years, that the stages tend to be a little bit shorter. There are some very, very short stages in this Vuelta a España, but there are a lot of stages around the 170, 180 kilometre mark as well, and those metres of climbing. So it's not, certainly on paper, it doesn't look like a sort of a kind of light snack of a Grand Tour, which maybe some people have thought about the Vuelta in the past. Just on Pogacar, oh, sorry, Lionel, you were...
Oh, I was just going to do my polka dot jersey supermarket corrections corner. Carrefour gave up sponsoring the Tour's polka dot King of the Mountains jersey many years ago. It's, of course, Leclerc now, isn't it? Anyway.
Another supermarket change.
Yeah.
Another supermarket. And in fact, it's...
Oh, it's gone round all the supermarkets. I think Champion as well.
But yeah, even supermarkets that don't exist anymore. Yeah. Which suggests that the sponsorship of the polka dot jersey wasn't very effective. Champion disappeared soon afterwards. I think they were taken over, actually. I think they were taken over by Leclerc or one of the others. Anyway, Lionel, also in Spain, of course, talking about Tadej Pogacar, it won't have escaped your notice that he was... It's fascinating, isn't it, how a climb that really never features in major races, the Col de Rates, has become this barometer that everyone uses for, and certainly the riders themselves, teams themselves, have kind of leaned into as this sort of ultimate test of how well they're riding, what kind of form they're in, and indeed just how good they are generally, because it's used on winter training camps by all the teams. We talked about a few weeks ago how all of the teams now go to the same area of, well, close to Valencia. And Pogacar smashed, destroyed his own KOM. And this was just a few hours. I don't know if you followed all this, Lionel, a sort of social media mini saga that took place over a few hours where the Unibet Rockets, they did the climb and took, I don't think they took, one of their riders took the record on the whole of the climb, but part of the climb. And then a few hours later, Pogacar went and took that KOM and also his own KOM on the whole segment. As I say, smashed it by sort of 30 seconds. And this was obviously with the whole team doing a lead out. But the time was quite astonishing for him to better his own time by, as I said, around half a minute.
Well, it's ominous, isn't it, ahead of 2026. But as we'll hear with the conversation with Juan Ayuso, certainly there's a kind of glimmer of hope that at least other riders, you know, UAE Team Emirates losing Juan Ayuso, at least he'd be on a rival team. And they're, you know, the sort of some of the focus will be elsewhere. There might be some sort of challenge. I mean, you're smiling doubtfully there, Daniel.
No, I'm smiling just thinking about it. Unfortunately, he got a mention as well last week, Ricardo Rico, the Cobra, and that paragon of moral virtue and credibility. He has done a YouTube video in which he picks apart exactly why Pogacar's KOM on the Col de Rates cannot be believed, and that he was clearly holding onto a car, and Rico refuses to believe this time until he produces the whole video and also his complete power file.
Anyone can flag a suspicious performance on Strava, can't they? So maybe if 30,
what's he waiting for?
40,000 cycling podcast listeners all hit Strava a bit later and protest, it will get taken down. Who knows?
There you go, Linus. So that's the Vuelta. We won't say any more, I don't think, about the Vuelta a España. And in fact, I think we are shortly going to sort of sign off for the festive period, or we're going to sort of cross over to Spain and go back on the space time continuum to my conversation with Dani Arribas last week. But Lionel, we've got a few things to say about what's going to happen over the festive period. We are releasing, well, there's another Kilometer Zero and the final installment of this trapdoor series about promotion relegation from the World Tour. We've done, you know, X, we've done Astana. The final installment for Friends of the Podcast is going to be on Cofidis, the sort of Cofidis debacle. How they got relegated from the World Tour. Not sure, Lionel, whether that's going to go out today or in the coming days. I'm still in negotiations, Lionel, over some of the material to be included in that. It's all quite sensitive, and those negotiations are going to continue today with one of the sources of information, shall we say.
What's that sort of censorship of criticism of coffee?
Well,
I mean, if that's the case, there'll be... Over our 13-year archive, there'll be huge blank bits in all of the episodes going back to 2013 because, a colleague of ours, Simon Richardson, when I worked together with him on Cycling Weekly, we used to nickname Cofidis Disappointing because they've often punched below their kind of standing and status. A big budget French team that's it's had more downs and ups, really, hasn't it? I mean, if you think back to the Tour de France a couple of years ago when they won a stage, it felt...
Two stages, sorry,
yeah. Well, when the first one was won, it felt a bit like a sort of... Well, it was so surprising, wasn't it? I mean, they weren't heralded
at all. It was the
first
one since 2008.
Yeah, and of course, there was a famous story about the bottle of champagne that had been heating up and cooling down and heating up and cooling down for... almost a decade in the luggage compartment of the Cofidis team bus, and finally they had a reason to pop that. I hope it tasted all right when they finally did pop that. But yeah, it's interesting that of all the teams that could have got relegated, Cofidis are, well, they've been down and up, haven't they? And they've kind of got the biggest safety net because of the fact they're a French team, because they have a long-standing sponsorship that goes back to, what was it, mid-90s, 96, 97, I think, first year.
97, yeah.
The first year of Cofidis. So, and also, they will undoubtedly always have a place in the Tour de France, even if they didn't qualify, by virtue of being a World Tour team or being one of the teams from outside the World Tour that is guaranteed an invite. You know, even if they fell another rung and a half down the ladder, they would still be confident of place in the Tour de France. But it'd be interesting to hear what their take on the whole relegation battle was, because it didn't look like they were panicking or putting together any sort of strategy, certainly nothing as noticeable as Astana, who really hit the ground running at the start of the year. And I think, without getting into this subject deeply, because it we maybe cover it in the new year, but one of the things about the whole promotion relegation battle was we clocked very early on what XDS Astana was going to do. It was obvious right from the start of the season. In fact, they were placing multiple riders in the top 10 in races at the end of January. So it's obvious what their strategy was. But you couldn't really make out what other teams were doing to kind of combat that, whether that was causing consternation and worry at other teams. I wouldn't look back at this season and think, well, Cofidis have really pulled out all the stops to try and preserve their World Tour status, really. But it'll be interesting to hear from their perspective how they feel this three-year cycle's gone. So that'll be out soon.
It will, imminently. And we, well, there might be another couple of episodes on the Friends feed, Kilometre Zero episodes, in the next couple of weeks before we return with regular programming in the new year. Is that right, Lauren?
Yeah, there will be a couple of things that I've got in the, well, they're kind of in the service course at the moment, ready for release over the Christmas period while we are taking a break. Keep an eye on the 1101 Cappuccino, our Substack, for details of those episodes, and that will be going out a bit later on this week. Also features, Daniel, your conversation with Kiel Karlstrom of the NSN team, which you trailed last week. The full conversation of that will be posted on Substack as well. That's coming in the next day or so. Before we go over to Juan Ayuso, can't let you get away with just skating over the cyclocross, Daniel. Our interest in cyclocross generally is where the intersection with the stars of road racing, that's kind of the point that we start to take real notice. And well, Mathieu van der Poel made his season debut in the cyclocross at the Namur World Cup, and he won it. He then added back-to-back victories over this most recent weekend, winning the World Cup races in Antwerp and Kokseide. Wout van Aert made his season's debut at Antwerp as well and finished seventh. When you look at their respective calendars for the next month or so in the cyclocross, it's a bit like a game of noughts and crosses or tic-tac-toe. The crosses of Mathieu van der Poel are very much avoiding the circles of Wout van Aert. They're not racing each other too often. A couple of the smaller races they may well go head-to-head in. And, well, Mathieu van der Poel has leapt up the World Cup standings by virtue of those three consecutive wins. And, well, we'll see what the rest of the cyclocross season has in store. Christmas is the season for cross. There's loads of racing on over the festive period. The Boxing Day cross at Gavura, Then there's the race at Dendermonde on the 28th of December, and the Floodlit Cross, which I know you'll be tuning into, Daniel, the one that takes place in the evening in Degham. That's always a really good watch. And yeah, I'm sure you'll be glued to the screen watching Matthew van der Poel hoover up some more victories.
Sounds thrilling, Lionel. Can't wait for all of that. Anyway, on that note, I think we should sleigh ride off into the Christmas night, if that's okay with you, Lionel. So after the break, we're going to hear from me and Danny Arribas talking about Little Trek and also Juan Ayuso, mainly. And Merry Christmas in the meantime to all of our listeners. Thank you for all of your support over the last 12 months, and look forward to being back after Christmas in the new year, and we're sinking our fangs into the 2026 season.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Good afternoon, everyone. Before we talk about the exciting future ahead of me together with Little Trek, there's a prepared statement I need to read to you. First of all, I want to take this opportunity at the press conference to start by thanking the entire team and structure of UIA. My time at UIA team members shaped me, and this will always remain a central part of my sporting career. During these formative years, I learned professionalism, discipline, and vision. The people on the team, particularly President Marta and Mauro Giannetti, contributed to my success and helped me to develop me into the rider I am today. I also want to address and close once for all that what happened last September. In that moment, I said something I genuinely did not believe, as I was under pressure and nervous. It does not reflect my true feelings, and I consider the matter fully closed. I want to end this chapter on good terms with you at Team Emirates. Thank you, everyone, for their support.
Well, Danny, what extraordinary stuff. Again, I feel like I've said this to you pretty much every time you've been on the podcast. You're too young, Danny. You won't remember this, but I'm going to try you just in case, because the gentleman I'm going to talk about was Spanish, is Spanish. There's a famous football manager, Rafa Benitez, who did something similar once in a press conference when he was the manager of Liverpool, and it was at the height of their rivalry with Manchester United, and he appeared at this press conference. He bowled in, Danny. He produced out of his pocket, I think, a sheet of paper, and he proceeded for sort of 15, 20 minutes to monologue about what he called facts. I am going to tell you the facts. And that was a bad accent.
It's some Rafa Benitez thing that I fully believe he did.
Yeah. And it was a whole load. It was a whole sort of laundry list of kind of accusations about, well, what Sir Alex Ferguson, the manager of Manchester United, had got wrong in his public statements. But it didn't really enhance Rafa Benitez, his image in the UK. I don't think there were there were some very unkind chants about Rafa Benitez at English football grounds, Danny. One of them being, "You're just a fat Spanish waiter," was a common one, a very common one. I don't know if you knew that. Anyway, we digress. Danny Arribas, you're back. You're back. This time reporting back from Little Trek. And Danny, why are we talking about this? Because we just heard Juan Ayuso begin his press conference at the Little Trek Media Day by reading out a statement. Now, he likes a statement. He likes a written statement, does Juan Ayuso, doesn't he? Because you could say this whole business started, his divorce from UAE, it began with a statement on the rest day of the Vuelta a España. Was it the first or the second rest day? I can't remember. I think it was the second,
just to be opposite to you.
okay. Purpose of this one. Well, we heard a little bit of it there, but Danny, why was this necessary?
First of all, there were much of an interest from Ayuso's side, not just from the rider, but from his entourage, to make sure this statement was well understood by general people, let's say, not just the media, because Juan was asking Spanish media right after 2 or 3 hours of interviews, was just asking us, okay, it was pretty clear why I read that or not.
Was it necessary? I don't think there's that much appetite to relitigate what happened between him and UAE. I kind of feel that it was pretty clear. It was pretty clean. In the end, it wasn't that contentious. It happened fairly quickly. It happened more quickly than we expected it to happen. So I didn't really think there was necessarily the need to do that. I mean, nothing wrong with it. It surprised me, to be honest.
To be honest, before going to the Lidl Trek camp, I was thinking there was not that high interest in the past with him, as he's, of course, one of the best riders of the peloton and he's joining Lidl Trek. But indeed, when we arrived there, there were this feeling that indeed there was this interest about talking about UAE.
What would you, I mean, we're going to hear you asking Juan Ayuso some questions in just a moment, but even in that interview, he said to you straight away he wasn't going to talk about UAE. But if you could have asked any question about Juan Ayuso's time at UAE or the way the divorce happened, what would you have asked? I'm struggling to think of what I would have asked. I mean, yeah, it would have been nice. It would have been, but I think we've had it. I think we had it to a certain extent, even at the Vuelta, where he sort of talked us through how it had come about. I remember him going into a lot of detail on that particular day about sort of the announcement that he was leaving. And he said they always planned to put this out, but probably at the end of the Vuelta. And of course, this was a day after he'd been seen to kind of go against team orders on a mountain stage of the race and not help a teammate, not help João Almeida. And Almeida had said something to that effect. It would have been nice to have a bit more support. So I think the following day, UAE put out a statement, or they went with Juan Ayuso. They went to Juan Ayuso and they said, we're not going to put this statement now out at the end of the Vuelta. We're going to put it out immediately. And they gave Juan Ayuso about half an hour to look at, to okay this. And he and his manager, Giovanni Lombardi, were both very aggrieved at this. And then they put out their own sort of statements, didn't they?
It was a statement, but especially was like a quick, not press conference, but quick answers to Spanish media, especially the radio stations.
Following morning, I remember, yeah.
Yeah, where Juan Ayuso, that's what everything turned up into, like a bad divorce situation, because Juan Ayuso there talked about, of course, he was disappointed with this come out that you just talk about. But I think the word that started everything was that he used dictatorship as a word to describe UAE's following that day. So I think, I truly believe, I don't have the confirmation, but I truly believe this statement read by Juan Ayuso has something to do with that word being used that day.
Do you think he'd been sort of dreading the moment for weeks? He'd been thinking about this media day and dreading the moment when inevitably the microphone was going to get passed to the sort of first journalist in the press conference, and their first question, their question was going to be, Juan, do you still think that UAE is a dictatorship?
I don't know, but it is quite flashy to me that at the first words from Juan Ayuso at Lidl Trek camp were just thanking Mauro Gianetti and Matar and all the UAE staff to helping him. So of course, there are theories about it, but not that much info. But it is something that, of course, Juan Ayuso and his entourage wanted to be clear about.
Yeah, but it was, as I said, it's not like the Derek G saga, where you feel a lot has happened that we don't know about, and it's been going on for weeks and weeks. And when the time comes, and by the time this podcast goes out, Derek G may indeed have signed for Lidl Trek, but there, it would be interesting to know exactly what has been going on for the last few weeks. And I'm sure there'll be people who want to ask those questions. We would like to ask those questions. But in this case, as I said, I don't have too many more.
A fun fact indeed that to let people understand how much of a bad divorce was that. It's not the first time, but you know, these days we're seeing many riders train with their new teammates in their former team kit. Remco Evenepoel, I don't know, the Movistar guys here in Spain, Raul García Pierna, Roger Adrià, Keanu De Brooks. But where we were driving to the Lidl Trek camp, training camp, Hotel La Sella there in Denia, we indeed saw Juan Ayuso riding by himself, going solo like a former teammate. And he was riding in a full black kit, not a Lidl Trek kit, of course, but neither UAE kit. So it's something that catch my attention over there. So
yeah, that's kind of curious. Just a reminder as well that Ayuso did finish the Vuelta a España for UAE. He didn't finish high up on general classification. It was 68th. He did ride two further races thereafter, the World Championships and the European Championships. So that Vuelta, that last stage of the Vuelta that was cancelled in Madrid, was his last official appearance in a UAE jersey. That was the press conference where the sort of the world's media had gathered to hear what Juan Ayuso had to say. You also spoke to Juan Ayuso in a more intimate setting, shall we say, a cycling podcast exclusive, you versus Juan Ayuso, no mention of UAE, that was strictly taboo. We'll hear that now, shall we?
First of all, a lot of interviews today, Juan, here in the training camp, all eyes on you today, the first day with the team. And everything started with reading a letter. Why you choose that?
Yeah, it was a written statement I had to say, and I said it. Hmm. And from there, I don't say more.
Okay, I understand. There were a bunch of teams interested in you in the last months, in the last years, would say. Why did you choose Lidl Trek? Why are you here now?
A lot of reasons, but yeah, just to try and make it simple. I think it was the only team that actually I believe what they were telling me. You know, a lot of teams promise you things and show you the project, but actually when I sat down with, especially with Luca, the way Luca spoke to me, the leadership Luca has, and then and also I met Thomas and Martin, which are, they come from the responsibles of Lidl. And they explained also that, you know, Lidl was gonna buy the team, and the team was gonna change completely, and it was gonna grow completely. To be honest, it was the only team I really believed what they were saying was true. They were gonna be able to, you know, to make it, and It's a team that really wants to grow, really wants to be the number one. For me, also importantly, apart from the resources the team has, is the mentality is really important, because you can have the resources, but if you don't have the mentality, the correct mentality, it's really hard to manage a team like this and to organize and a team like this. Luca and all the team around him is really have a mentality of being to try and keep innovating, to try and keep finding new ways of how we can improve our performance. I really believe in the project, and that's why I chose.
You're still so young at this point. It doesn't seem that you're the youngest that you have today. But what are you expecting from the team? Not just as a rider, of course, you have talked about it, especially as a person at this point of your career.
I found myself in these I was 1 week in Germany and now only nearly a week here. But especially all the meetings I've had also on the phone and, you know, what the team expects from me and all this. I found a very human side in this team, where they're very ambitious, they want to be the best, but also understand we're humans and there'll be ups and downs, and that's totally normal. As I said, when other colleague of yours asked me what in these first meetings when I spoke with Luca, what they told me, what did they expect from me, didn't tell me nothing. You know, it was just pure confidence and pure just how the team is going to support me. The pressure is basically the one I put on myself. And of course, I know the team expect big things of myself, but they never told me you have to achieve this or you have to achieve that. It's just pure confidence in believing in me and just giving me the right support. So on that side, I feel like this is also a very human group. and especially the Luca and Thomas, which are our bosses, really understand we're human and things are going to happen for sure, and that's also part of the way up.
You bring here Paco Luna, the master you had at the UAE years. You have a lot of confidence with him, of course. You did not bring Íñigo San Millán. Tell us a bit about it. Why?
I would have loved Íñigo to come, to be honest. He's also been a fundamental, part of me growing as an athlete. He's been my trainer since I finished being junior until this year. And he's, one of the main persons I most trust, and one of the persons that's, helped me become the rider I am today. But also, Íñigo now has a, very big responsibility in Athletic de Bilbao. And he has a lot of responsibility over there. And the team also have a philosophy of the trainers traveling to the races, the trainers traveling to altitude camps, and basically, my trainer to follow me everywhere around all my calendar, which unfortunately that was not going to be able for Íñigo to do. So I had to respect the philosophy also of the team and understand it.
You have started to work, or you are starting indeed to work with Aritz. Of course, you're knowing still each other, but what would be like the key point for you to establish like a good relationship from the beginning with him?
I've already established a super good relationship. I think I get along very well. It's only now the start of December, so the training I've done until now is quite simple, because it's just to start doing the base. You don't start to do intervals or new things until you have a minimum of form, which I'm now starting to get. I haven't really experienced all the new techniques and all the new way of working with Aritz yet, because it's still December. But just on the personal side, he's a super nice guy. He's super understanding. Also, again, a super super human. Understands the human part of cycling, and I think we're gonna get along very well.
Right after the team announced your signing, Juan, Matías Esquilmós was a bit disappointing. I want to ask you if you have talked with him, or even if you kind of understood his point at the time, back in the time.
Yeah, actually, Matías and we had a team camp in Germany, and he came to apologize for making these statements. So I think that was also really nice for him. And from there, for me, there's really no issue, and I can, I'm the first one to speak on the press a lot of times, and sometimes you make mistakes, and then I spoke with Matías, and I'm really looking forward to be racing with him.
Could you remind us once more time your calendar for next year?
Yeah, of course. I'll start in Algarve, and then I'll be going to Paris-Nice, then País Vasco, then Flèche, and my first time in Liège, so that'll be my first monument, and then Dauphiné and Tour.
Of course, all eyes are on the Tour one more year. As always, you have talked about it. Like, what would be like a realistic goal for you over there on France?
Aiming super high, but still being realistic, is to try and be on the podium. It's the first time I go to the Tour for myself, and first time I'll take on the Tour in a serious way, going for the GC. It's going to be year by year. I'm still going to be improving, and this is only the first year of this project. Shooting high is the podium, but we shouldn't go crazy. And if it doesn't happen this year, I just have to keep on working and keep on going.
You have always been like a winner, not just on race, but also on mentality. But you talk about a very interesting thing, at least for me, which is that you admit some riders are still above of your level at this point of your career. You're so young; they are older than you. How many riders would you say, at least as a GC contenders, are above of you right now?
Well, I don't want to count them out, because maybe I forget one, or they'll say nobody thinks he's better than this or that. Undoubtedly, I'm still young, and Tadej, of course, Remco, Vingegaard. All these guys are older than me, and I think every year I can keep on progressing and close that gap. I've been on the podium once, and then, of course, obviously I've never won a Grand Tour, so So of course there's better people than me because other people are winning them and I haven't. I'm a very ambitious person, but I'm also, I think, realistic, and I know where I am.
I want to know if you consider yourself a GC rider more of any other type of rider.
Yes, I think so. I perform well in one-day races. I still haven't raced the Monument, so I'll be nice this year to really see where I am. Especially in one-week races, I've always performed well, and in Grand Tours, I've always felt like second, third weeks are good for me because I think I recover quite well. Yeah, as I say, this year will be a nice year because I go to the tour with full support, so it'll be nice to see where I am.
You signed with the team for 5 years. If I'm not mistaken, you'll be 28 at the time that it comes to an end, which is probably the peak of a cyclist's career. How would success look like if you look back right at 2030?
That's a really hard question to ask us. And nowadays we live every
day by day,
race by race. And next week is the most important weeks of our life. And we live like this all the time. So it's hard to say. It's like you say, when you retire, what will be, what do you think will be good? It's pretty hard to answer. I just hope, I keep on progressing. I keep on, delivering to the team, giving back the confidence. And I don't want to say a result in a specific because I think that's also unfair.
Would you at least be happy if every year there's an improvement in yourself?
Even before results, for me, the most important thing is to keep on improving physically and to see every year I get better. It's a satisfaction that's, I would say, even deeper than going to a race and winning. Because sometimes you go to a race, you win, and you're not necessarily the best. Whereas when you keep on improving, you see a satisfaction in yourself, which is way deeper. So as I say, this is one of my biggest goals this year, which is to keep on improving. And I think especially this year with the help of the team.
Very interesting stuff. Juan Ayuso is always he's a good communicator, isn't he? He's a good talker. He's a very good interview. What did you learn from your 12 minutes in his company there?
Well, first of all, probably not the most important thing, but he's a very good English talker, Daniel. It's not that common here in Spain.
Of course, we know that was it 4 years he spent in Atlanta?
Yeah, 3-4 years, but he was so young in Atlanta when he was just like a little kid, but he's still maintaining this good English. So that's something that catch my attention, of course.
We also learned about his plans for 2026, and we learned that his main objective of the year will be Tour de France. This is after he's gone to the Algarve, then Paris-Nice, then Tour of the Basque Country, then Flèche Wallonne, and Liège. Thereafter, he'll be doing the Dauphiné. We're still calling it the Dauphiné. And the Tour de France. Very interesting prospect, isn't it, Danny? Because, I mean, Juan Ayuso, obviously, just to sort of recap, he burst onto the scene with that historic first appearance in the Vuelta a España in 2022, wasn't it? Where he was the youngest podium finisher of all time, or youngest podium finisher for many, many decades. And he was third in that Vuelta a España as a teenager, wasn't he? He was 19 years old, I believe. Since then, it's been a very mixed bag for him in Grand Tours. Fourth in the Vuelta a España the following year. And in 2024, of course, that was, I suppose, that was where the sort of sense that he wasn't particularly happy at UAE or particularly happy with the hierarchy at UAE, that was where it started to take root in that Tour de France in 2024. The famous stage to Valois, of course, where João Almeida was sort of gesturing because João Almeida was sort of trailing at the back of the lead group. He didn't finish that race, and that was his only Grand Tour in 2024. Of course, he wasn't sent to the Vuelta, and that was kind of quite controversial at the time. And then last year, he got sick, didn't he, at the Giro d'Italia? This was after it had already, the sickness had already started to affect his results.
He was sick, and after that, beaten by a bee in the face. Do you remember that?
Ah, yes, of course. We had the bee sting, didn't we, and the big sort of swollen eye, and he pulled out Because, well, he could barely see out of one eye. And then, of course, he went to the Vuelta a España. We talked about this a lot at the time, didn't we, Danny? That there didn't seem to be any particularly good reason for him not to be ready and firing at the Vuelta a España. And he left a bit of kind of ambiguity going into the Vuelta about whether he was or wasn't going for GC. And then as soon as things started to go wrong, then he said, well, I was never going to go for GC at the Vuelta. Of course not. Of course not. Then he was we thought he was going to become a super domestique for João Almeida. We already touched on one day where he certainly wasn't that. But he continued to perform, pull off these spectacular individual exploits. One stage win at Cerler after 170 kilometers in the break on or off the front on his own. And then another stage win in Asturias, was it? Los Corrales de Huelna. So, Danny, really, his Grand Tour career so far peaked with that very first appearance in Grand Tours. And so, obviously, a lot of question marks, really, because he's shown his great potential. He's shown these great sort of flourishes in Grand Tours. He had a fantastic start to the season last year where he was almost sort of Pogacar-esque, riding away from fields and, you know, dropping everyone on climbs. But we haven't really seen him ride consistently in Grand Tours yet. And that's the big question, isn't it, at Little Trek? Is he going to be that guy? We know that this is a team that's getting bigger and bigger, more and more money involved. Lidl, the supermarket chain, have bought the team now, and that's sort of taken them up another notch. But until now, they haven't had a big GC leader. Obviously, they've recruited a couple of guys who they thought might become that. Theo Gegenhardt a couple of years ago, of course, but he was still recovering from that dreadful crash he had at the Giro d'Italia in his last year at Ineos. It hasn't quite panned out for him yet. So Ayuso is the first marquee GC signing, and they're sending him to the Tour de France.
Mm-hmm. He is, but at the same time, he underlined in his press conference that the leader for the Tour de France is going to be Mats Pedersen. So it's something, of course, we are talking here about hierarchy, but we are not, or nobody's expecting Mats Pedersen, of course, to win the Tour de France. Probably Ayuso is a contender there, not probably the main favorite, as he's conscious that not just Pogacar, but also Vingegaard and Remco Evenepoel are still, as by his own words, above him on level for Grand Tours. He talked about the realistic goal of having a podium or getting a podium there in France in next summer. Is going to be the first Grand Tour as a sole leader or as a solid leader for a team, as he went to the Tour de France last year. Not last year, 2 years ago, with Pogacar and company in UAE.
Talking a minute about the sort of entourage that he's going to have and whether he's kind of brought anyone with him at Little Trek. But just, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you had to name the next Spanish Grand Tour winner, or maybe the next Tour de France, next Spanish Tour de France winner, is your feeling, and is the feeling of people in the sport that still... Ayuso is still the most talented, even if we look sort of further down the line to riders like Pablo Torres and even younger riders currently like Noval, who's coming through and will be probably turning pro with Ineos in a couple of years. But is the feeling and your feeling that Ayuso is still the most talented Spanish rider that you currently have?
Yeah, those were Torres and Noval, the two names I was thinking of. But Torres is super young still and has to prove a lot of things in the Grand Tour. And Noval is, I don't know which type of rider it is. Probably he doesn't know even yet, as he's super young. But yeah, Ayuso, it is probably the most talented rider, the most talented Spanish rider at the moment, and probably for the next years, as he's just... He turned 23 this last September, so he's probably younger than most of people think, because he's over there just fighting with Pogacar, Remco and Vingegaard. Of course, he's something that he points out every time that he could. He was talking about this, saying, yeah, these guys are above me, but these guys are not much, but a bit older than me yet. So I have a big space for improvement. And he is convinced, indeed, that he is a GC rider, which is something that I don't know if it's clear to me yet, but in the team, they believe that he can be a GC rider. But I don't know, maybe I see on a Justo more of a Valverde than a Contador type of rider.
Yeah, and there are certain similarities in his GC career so far to Remco Evenepoel's GC career, in that sort of that struggle to find consistency, and they're both still young. I mean, Ayuso younger than Evenepoel, but it may not be coincidence that both of their outstanding successes in Grand Tours thus far came in the same race, 2022 Vuelta a España, and it may be that in the fullness of time in the future we come to look back on that race as a maybe unusual race, or as a race that was a bad guide of sort of future potential in Grand Tours.
And the year after, he finished fourth, right after the Jumbo Visma, three riders on the podium, the Roglic, Vingegaard and Kuss. But yeah, and I fully agree with that.
Well, obviously the friends that he can make and that he can sort of kind of assimilate into his circle and create a sort of circle of influence and trust at Little Trek. That's obviously going to be important. It is for any big rider. In this case, he's not bringing a whole entourage with him, is he? He's not bringing a coach with him. I think he's bringing one masseur with him, but he's not bringing a lot of domestiques with him. So that has to be kind of built and created.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Now, we're going to hear a little bit more now from someone who has known him for a while, but has been working at Little Trek for a number of years as well, and is now one of the people who are going to have to sort of help Juan Ayuso settle at his new team. It's a countryman, but it's a Basque, Josu Larrazabal. He is the head of performance at Little Trek, isn't he, Danny? And you also spoke to him at the Little training camp last week. So let's hear now from Josu Larrazabal.
During the Vuelta, we start looking each other when we were crossing each other, but we knew that we could not talk. That was funny, let's say. But okay, straight after he finished the season, we had the chance to talk before, but I say, yeah, let's finish the season. And yeah, after the Europeans, we have the first video call, and then we start talking about what was coming before the break, with the meeting in Germany at the Lidl headquarters, with this camp, all the change and transition with the people that will work around him, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, October. Actually, even being Spanish, I was never in a situation to meet him before. Like I could have maybe met other riders that they were never in the team, but in this case, no. I just met him a couple of months ago.
Do you remember the first race even before this year? I'm talking about years before the first race. You knew about him as a rider, maybe as a very young rider.
The first race I remember was the World Championship that Quinn Simmons won in, I think was Harrogate. Juan was already somewhere there with Carlos Rodriguez and those guys. But I didn't even know his face at that time. The very first race where he called my attention, and I told him that, and I explained him that why, etc., was the day in his first Vuelta. I think was somewhere in Jaén area where there was a uphill finish, and he broke the bike, and he ride with the Shimano bike for a few kilometers, you know, and that was the first day that he really called my attention. And yeah, since then, I always I was looking to him and to his interviews, because in the beginning was not really sympathetic to me. And I told him, yeah, so that I can talk about that, because the first thing I did was talk to him about this. Those interviews in that Vuelta, I always like to listen to interviews from riders, because you can get a lot of details. And I really like the way he was approaching that Vuelta, being a young guy and dealing with those situations. And since then, especially since that day, then I start always looking, you know, a little bit. So happy that we had the chance to have him on board.
What you didn't like back in the day, if you can say it?
Yeah, I think it's like we are always conditioned by opinions, by, you know, he could look like an arrogant guy, but he's not. It's really easy to talk to him. He can talk in detail and explain everything. He likes to, like many Spanish people, our cultural thing is pretty social, and he's that guy, but in the beginning he will, from outside, he will feel like more cold or whatever. But of course, because we are always influenced, and maybe sometimes we judge too early. But I don't have any problem on recognizing that, because I think everyone did that mistake sometimes.
It's a natural thing.
I never had like any bad comment or any bad comment about him or whatever. It was just my impression. But then I still give a chance, because otherwise, if I would have done the cross, then I would never listen to his interviews. But I was still listen to his interviews. So, and then it was so natural that I did not have any problem on sharing that with him. So
going to the present, what would you think changed for the team with him on the squad?
Yeah, it changed a lot. It changed on a guy with the potential itself. Himself is already a big addition. Then adding one more, then you are adding numbers. So it's not like we have now in certain situations, Ciccone and Skelly to be able to face some situations like, okay, Parini is a Tirreno, what we do? We go with 1-1 like last year, Skelly in one race, Chico on the other one. Now, whatever you put Juan, you will have already at least two strong riders to be in those situations. This sport of being everything pretty equal, having numbers, it's already good. And then one of them, in this case, we are talking about Juan, when he will be ready to win a Grand Tour or to win any race, then, now having the numbers means that we will have also a good enough support to cover any race situation, like in the flat with the Mats and riders of the Classic, let's say, and in the climbs with Skelly, with Chico, with Lenny, with Lennart, with Theo, at this point we have a strong riders that we are able to compare ourselves with any other team.
Did you personally understand Skelmo's words when team announced Juan Sagnin?
No, when you take the headline, of course not. That's why we have a talk, and then we talk when he was at Worlds on the phone, and then in that case was Luca talking to him on the phone, and then I sent him a message, and then we sit in Italy and we talk about it. Then of course you realize that was taken away from the conversation, was a little bit out of context when he said that he put himself like, if I'm smaller than Pogacar, I will never expect that he will come here to help me, but not saying like he should help me and he will not do it. Like, but everything was messed up and taken out completely out of context. He's such a good person, and I'm pretty sure they will fit well, and it will take its time, because at the end they are so similar riders and they were fighting each other in more than one race. So at the end it's normal they will need to share that space. But you will see when the race calendars come out that they will be together in many races. So we will not even avoid putting them away from each other, because we think our strength will be exactly that, mm-hmm. Putting them together and and creating that right relationship. And knowing Matthias, knowing Juan now after 2 months, I'm pretty confident that it will work. Mm-hmm. It will work.
Mm-hmm. Juan just described himself as a GC rider. Do you see him just as a GC rider?
No, I mean, he's 23. How he can know already what the type of rider is? Of course, he has done the most of the results in those races, and of course, I guess he feels like mentally, he likes those kind of. But as a coach, he can still look for any goal he could dream, like even classics. Why not? I mean, Juan can win a Lombardia. Why not? Lies. Why not? He's fast. He's climbing good. I don't think he has limits. I mean, he's even good time trialing against the very top ones. So if he likes more the GC, then I can understand he will maybe focus more on that and he will enjoy that more. But as a technician, I cannot see his limits. The same way I don't see the limits of Skelly. Skelly was beating Pogacar and Remco in the Amstel. I think the same way Juan can do things like that and win big classics. No discussion.
Could you tell us a bit about Aritz, the person who's going to be coaching Juan this upcoming year?
What can I say about Aritz? I followed the growth of Aritz when I was working in the Fundación Euskadi. Aritz was one of our riders, so he finished the university. I was his tutor on the practice period of the university in that agreement we had between the Fundación Euskadi and University of Basque Country. After that, he started straight away coaching and being a sport director in the Fundación Euskadi itself with Orbea. And then he did his way with Skydive, and I could help him a little bit joining Astana. In those times, I was already at Trek, but I could not. It was not the moment to bring him on board because it was not the right timing. He had to do his way, and then he from Astana he went by himself. Because he's really a strong coach to Bahrain, and he did a really good job there as well. And then in the moment we could grow, he asked to look at that. Was the first signing we did as coach. He has worked with the top level riders. He has worked with riders that they were specialized in GC. And now when Juan came, I didn't have any doubt that was the perfect match and was with the first suggestion I came to Juan, and Juan was happy to give a try and work with the team and change his, he changed team with all the compromise to do it on the way I come to a new team, and then I give a chance to the existing staff and performance team.
What would it be the goal for Juan for 2026 season?
Juan's career is not starting now. It's already going on. So of course, he has been in podiums of Grand Tour, so of course when you are already there, then you want to win. We consider all the options, going to the Giro, going to the Tour, what to do, what is best. Maybe look into the calendars of the others could give us the chance to maybe get a better result straight away, but we are not stressed about that. With Trek being an owner, we have been always working on the medium, long term, even more now with Lidl. We choose the Tour. We know it's hard to win the Tour straight away. Of course, winning the Tour is a goal, medium term. So we will start investing on that. But because it's not only about Juan, it's also about testing the team, putting together Juan, Skelly, Chico, Lenny, Mats Pedersen, Quinn Simmons, Bacek. I mean, winning the Tour is not only about having a strong rider in certain situations, it's having a strong leader, it's having a good, a strong backup, because otherwise you cannot make pressure to other teams. If you have only one rider, if you have two, even better. We know Skelly keeps growing. And we don't know. We don't know the sailing of Juan. We don't know the sailing of Skelly. They are still both young and they keep growing. So, yeah, we choose the Tour. We go for the Tour, being conscious of all the strong points and all the things that we need to keep working to close that gap. But okay, this is not mathematics.
We'll see.
So, Danny, we've heard from Ayuso himself. We've heard from, if not the gentleman who's going to be coaching, the gentleman who's sort of overseeing, well, not just his coaching, not just Ayuso's coaching, but the whole team's coaching. And, well, there are other sort of questions to be answered as well about him fitting in, not fitting in with staff, but fitting in with other riders, particularly riders with GC objectives. And there's already been a bit of a minor beef. Shall we say, beef's probably stretching it a little bit, but Josu Larrazabal addressed it in the interview you did with him, but there has been a lot of talk online about Skelmoza. And there was another sort of moment, I believe, at the training camp where Skelmoza, you weren't in this particular interview session, I don't think, with Skelmoza, but he was asked about the Ardennes Classics, and one of the journalists put it to Skelmoza that Ayuso had already said, or the team had already said, Ayuso was the man for the Ardennes Classics. And Skelmoza reacted then in a similar way to how he'd reacted when he was sort of first asked about Ayuso. It was sort of, oh, that's news to me, or that's a surprise to me, or the first I've heard about it.
Yeah, he indeed said that that's news to me. I was told that I would be the sole leader in the Ardennes, which we can remember that Ayuso is riding Flesch and Liège there. So yeah, it was kind of surprising for him, but most surprising was on our side to see, in this case, Matthias Esclemos underlining that in front of the journalists.
It would be a bit of a surprise for me as well. I think Skelmoza's credentials in those races are at least equal, and I would suggest superior to Ayuso's. Of course, Skelmoza has won Amstel Gold, and he's also, you know, he's performed really well in Flèche Wallonne in the past. So it would surprise me. I mean, often these things, I mean, we heard Josu there talk about how things can be taken out of context. I wonder whether something has kind of been lost in communication or translation here as well. But it's going to be really interesting to see how those two dovetail, how those two work together, because they are doing quite a few races together this year. And, you know, Skelmoza has got, he's no sort of shrinking violet, as we say in the UK. I mean, he's not Mads Pedersen, but he's a guy who has quite strong ideas, is quite strong-minded, has always been my impression. And I think he expects to be leading the team when he goes to sort of hilly races and so on and so forth. Incidentally, I mean, I've mentioned this before. I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Ayuso on the podcast. Mads Pedersen, in my mind, is going to be the best possible influence, and he's the best possible team captain in this situation. We'll talk about Pedersen himself and his own objectives in a minute, but I think that Pedersen will Daniel Benson said in the podcast last week, he won't stand for any of that shit, i.e. any friction or that may be caused by Ayuso. I'm not suggesting he's going to cause any friction, but I think Ayuso will fall into line, and everyone falls into line when they're racing with Mads Pedersen, is my impression.
It is my impression too. But the thing you were talking about, Matthias Esclemos, he's a rider that is so transparent, so honest with the media, and sometimes, and especially in this case, that could be, and I say again, could be not the best strategy for him, as probably after the first thing that he said when Ayuso came to the team. We just heard Josu Larrazabal talking about it, and Luca Garcilena called directly Matthias Esclemos during the Worlds to clarify all that happened. And then, yeah, Ayuso told us that indeed Esclemos apologized to me in Germany. But right after that, giving us media, it is good for us, but giving us the present of, okay, I didn't know Ayuso was going as well to the Ardennes. I was told all the thing. It is something that probably, of course, I insist, is good for us media, but it's not the best strategy for him and for the team.
As we know, the Danish media is always very well represented at bike races, and they can be quite in, you know, I mean, I've got lots of very good friends in the Danish media. They can be quite intense, you know, and if there is any kind of controversy to be extracted, they will find it and they will extract it purely by virtue of, for example, the number of hours of airtime that they have to fill. You know, generally, Danny, when we're in the mix zone doing interviews for whether it's a podcast or TV. We're doing sort of 1 minute interviews, 2 minute interviews. The Danes are doing 6 and 7 minute interviews, these epic interviews with people, and they will cross examine you.
I wouldn't expect that from Danish media, to be honest, before you tell me.
From who?
No, I wouldn't have expect this from Danish media or Danish people, to be honest. But yeah.
No, they're formidable.
They are indeed, yeah.
Yeah. The other side note to all of this, maybe quite surprisingly in the context, is that Little Trek also have announced that Skelmose has signed a contract extension with them until the end of 2028. So he's not going anywhere, although as we know nowadays, and as the Ayuso case demonstrated, these long contracts can and sometimes are broken. What else did we find out from Little Trek? Well, this had been speculated about and I think widely predicted. Jonathan Milan, who was of course one of the star sprinters at the Tour de France in 2025, is going to be sent to the Giro d'Italia in 2026. And that leaves a clear path for Mads Pedersen to return to the Tour de France after a year out. That was certainly another big thing that we learned.
Yeah, indeed. I used to in his press conference talk about this, underlining that Mads Pedersen winning the green jersey at Paris at the Tour de France would be like the biggest goal for the team there over there in France. So yeah, it's something that probably is not what Jonathan Miller was expecting from this year, but it's something different from what happened in 2025, and I guess they are switching calendars to the green jerseys.
Pedersen, of course, will be their leader at the Classics, as we expect. I would imagine that he'll be very strong again in the Classics, you know, right up there with Van der Poel and Van Aert et al. Danny, the Giro, do we know anything about the Giro? Apart from Milan, do we know about GC leaders at the Giro? Of course, they've got Ciccone is going to concentrate on stage wins. It feels like he does that every sort of second year. He announces that he's abandoning GC, and then next year it'll be back to concentrating on GC again. But
Tivones is going to the Giro as well. Giulio Ciccone is going to.
Ah, okay. But I think we've covered the main talking points, haven't we? I mean, of course, the sort of general context for this team is, well, Little Trek are very much on the up, aren't they? They finished the year third in the UCI rankings, and I would suggest that they're in sort of direct competition. I would even say they're in direct competition with Visma. I mean, we used to sort of think of Visma and UAE inhabiting their own sort of super tier A of teams, but I would now say, particularly with what we know or think we know about Visma Lisa Bike's budget maybe not being what it was, or certainly nothing like UAE's, I think there is a sort of, there's a tier, isn't there, Danny? Visma, Little Trek, Red Bull, and if you were being really kind, you could include Ineos in there, certainly in terms of their ambitions, and maybe also Sudal Quickstep. But I think Little Trek will want to be at the top of that pile, second in the world behind UAE.
Yeah, that would be the best case scenario for them, I guess.
So that is Little Trek. Danny, anything else that you would like to report back from Little Trek?
I don't think so. I mean, we heard about some rumors about other rider, and I was told that Saturday he arrived there. I don't know if you...
Oh, Derek G, of course. Yeah, this may all be redundant by the time the podcast comes out. And Derek G, that deal might have been signed, sealed and delivered. But that's a kind of surprising one. Again, as we talked about earlier on, that's been a bit of a black box, that whole affair. I'm not really sure. I don't think anyone's really sure exactly what's gone down there, and maybe we will find out in due course. But it's certainly one that until about 10 days ago I did not see coming. I imagine, we talked about the Giro d'Italia, who's going to lead the Giro d'Italia. If he has come in, then he's an obvious choice, I would suggest, for leadership at the Giro d'Italia. But it'll be interesting to see how G develops, because there have been times over the last couple of years when he's looked as though he could become one of the very best three or four stage race riders or Grand Tour riders in the world. And that would obviously sort of tread on Juan Ayuso's toes and maybe Skelmoser's toes further. On that note, I'm going to wish you a Merry Christmas. Where are you going for Christmas? What are you doing for Christmas?
I'm going to Valencia, not Costa Blanca, but Valencia, as my
not
girlfriend.
Not returning to Benidorm?
No. My girlfriend is from there, so I'm going with her family. But yeah, it's a city and an area, Daniel, that I have to say I like it pretty much, to be honest.
Always scores, Danny, very highly in sort of rankings, tables of the highest quality of life, cities with the highest quality of life in Europe. I've seen Valencia top those standings on a number of occasions. Danny, unfortunately, at the Vuelta a España over the last few years, I mean, we're often in that area, but we don't often go right into the sort of teeth of Valencia. So it's a city I don't really know that well, in spite of having heard very good things about it. So maybe get the opportunity to explore Valencia more in the coming years. Hopefully, fingers crossed. But Danny, thank you for your contributions to the Cycling Podcast this year. And hopefully you'll be joining us at the Vuelta next year. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. And Daniel, didn't ask you, where are you going in Christmas?
Oh, I'm going to London. I'm in Berlin at the moment, but I'll be in London for about a week with family, doing family things. We have a big Polish celebration because half of my family is Polish. Danny, so we have these sort of traditional Christmas Eve involving sort of wafers and also this whole kind of rigmarole around Polish Christmas Eve. Anyway, that's what I'm doing, but we'll be back in the new year.
Good to know. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, Daniel.
Thank you, mate.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 daily double meal deal, each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. There's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's. For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
One of the biggest challenges of earning a degree as a military veteran is transitioning your goals and experiences to your next phase in life. National University gets it. As a veteran-founded Yellow Ribbon School, they offer post-9/11 GI Bill acceptance, dedicated military support and advising services, and credit for your military experience. That's why 30% of their students are military affiliated. NU, education that serves those who served.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue, the $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 daily double meal deal, each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. There's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's. For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.